Constraints on Perfection. In 1979, John Maynard Smith organized a conference at the Royal Society on the evolution of adaptation by natural selection. John Krebs and I were each invited to give talks, and we decided to pool our efforts and write a joint one on the subject of evolutionary arms races. We already knew we could work well together because of our 1978 paper on animal signals, information or manipulation. I count John as an intellectual brother, although we see too little of each other nowadays. We have always laughed at the same absurdities without the need for explanation. When unpacking his effects as he moved back into the Oxford Zoology Department after a spell abroad, he came upon a useful item that made him think of me. "Richard, if ever you should have need of a false beard..." Was he being prophetic? The day may yet come. As with my sister Sarah, I can count on John's past to include the same funny books and poems as my own. We effortlessly take each other's allusions. Though a little younger than me, he rightly won his FRS long before I did. Unlike me, he can cope with university politics and civil service administration and combine them with doing excellent science. He became the knighted head of the British Food Standards Agency and is now a member of the House of Lords and the head of Jesus, a beautiful old Oxford college. The opening paragraph of our arms race paper, as delivered at the Royal Society Conference in 1979, set the scene. Foxes and rabbits race against each other in two senses. When an individual fox chases an individual rabbit, the race occurs on the timescale of behaviour. It is an individual race, like that between a particular submarine and the ship it is trying to sink. But there is another kind of race, on a different timescale. Submarine designers learn from earlier failures. As technology progresses, later submarines are better equipped to detect and sink ships, and later designed ships are better equipped to resist. This is an arms race, and it occurs over a historical timescale. Similarly, over the evolutionary timescale, the fox lineage may evolve improved adaptations for catching rabbits, and the rabbit lineage improved adaptations for escaping. We arranged our examples according to a four-way distinction between inter versus intra-specific arms races, e.g. predator-prey versus male-male rivalry, and between symmetric versus asymmetric arms races, e.g. male-male rivalry versus parent-offspring conflict. We considered how arms races end, whether in victory for one side or in some kind of equilibrium. Inspired by an Aesop fable, we coined the life-dinner principle as a way for an arms race to end in victory. The rabbit runs faster than the fox because the rabbit is running for his life while the fox is only running for his dinner. There is an asymmetry in the cost of failure on the two sides of the arms race. The asymmetry shows itself in economic terms. Both rabbit and fox would run like a Maserati if they could, but the machinery for running fast is costly. It has to be paid for out of other parts of the body's economy. The life-dinner asymmetry gives the rabbit an added inducement to divert precious resources into running speed. A similar asymmetry arises in the rare enemy effect. Every one of the cuckoo's ancestors must have succeeded in fooling a foster parent, whereas the foster parent can look back on many ancestors that never encountered a cuckoo in their lives. The cost of failure is higher for the cuckoo than the host, so cuckoos, whose ancestors survived the more stringent side of the arms race, are better equipped to survive future encounters. The arms race idea has proved immensely fruitful and has pervaded many of my books. My friend, the Cambridge zoologist N.B. Davies, who could fairly be seen as co-founder with John Krebs of the modern version of behavioural ecology, makes inspired use of the arms race idea in his classic fieldwork on cuckoos. Perhaps the most overrated paper in my field, if not in all of biology, originated at the same Royal Society conference. S.J. Gould and R.C. Lewontin's 1979 Critique of the Adaptationist Programme. Lewontin and Gould were alpha males in the field, powerful ringleaders of the 1970s campaign against Edward O. Wilson, who, fortunately, was well able to look after himself. And the bullying tone continued at the 1979 Royal Society conference. Lewontin wasn't there, so Gould gave the lecture and was at his sneering best, playing for the horse laugh from the back row and mysteriously ignoring the fact that his central thesis had been comprehensively undermined earlier in the day by the thoughtful and thorough presentation of Tim Clutton Brock and Paul Harvey on comparison and adaptation. Perhaps Gould's failure to deal with Clutton Brock and Harvey can be excused on the grounds that he had little time to alter his paper. But a brief nod in their direction and a diminuendo on the sneers would have been courteous. The argument was about whether, when we look at some feature of an animal, it is right to assume that it has been shaped by natural selection. Is it necessarily an adaptation? Gould and Lewontin's attack on such alleged adaptationism, an earlier coinage of Lewontin, was largely aimed at straw men or at second-rate biology, a far cry from what we might call thoughtful adaptationism. Clutton Brock and Harvey undermined the Gould-Lewontin attack by demonstrating sophisticated quantitative techniques for testing adaptation hypotheses with true scientific rigour. These techniques, mostly statistical variants of the comparative method, have proceeded apace in subsequent years in the hands of both Clutton Brock and Harvey themselves and of others, including my sometime pupil, Mark Ridley, and later workers at Oxford, fostered by Paul Harvey during his very successful years as our professor of zoology. I'm sure I would be criticised as a rampant adaptationist, but my main contribution in print to the debate was actually called Constraints on Perfection, the chapter with that title in The Extended Phenotype. A thoughtful, rather than straw version of adaptationism, not under that name, had been a major influence in Oxford zoology when I was an undergraduate. It was fostered by my own maestro, Nico Tinbergen, and by the school of E.B. Ford, founder of the subject of ecological genetics and a devoted disciple of Sir Ronald Fisher, prodigious innovator in the field of statistics, as well as that of population genetics. Ford was such a pernickety aesthete, it is hard to imagine him as a field worker, but he and his many talented colleagues, including Bernard Kettlewell, Arthur Kane and Philip Shepherd, did indeed go out into the woods and fields to measure the pressures of natural selection in nature. Their samplings of butterflies, moths and snails, along with the parallel school of American geneticists under Theodosius Dobzhansky, with whom Lewontin studied, found something quite unexpected. Selection pressures in the wild are hugely stronger than anyone had imagined. Seemingly trivial differences turned out to be massively reflected in differential mortality. I have already mentioned Marek Cohn's A Reason for Everything, a spirited group portrait of the British school of natural selectionists. Cohn rightly says that Ford left behind him an intensely selectionist atmosphere that enveloped Oxford zoology and a legend upon which he had worked as meticulously as on his Lepidoptera. That legend included a cultivated misogyny. Miriam Rothschild was one honoured exception, possibly because she was literally the honourable, the daughter of a lord, and Ford was a snob. I only met him face to face once, although I attended all his lectures, and I saw him in the department often, using his outstretched hand to thread his way fastidiously through the plebeian throng at coffee time. He called it cocoa, refusing to admit the existence of Nescafe, in much the same way as he preferred not to acknowledge dogs, calling them pussy. Cohn relates how Ford once startled a dog-owning lady by inquiring solicitously after her pussy. The one time I met him socially, his shrewd, even cunning eyes led me to doubt the sincerity of his eccentric pose. On the other hand, the report, which I think originated with Philip Shepherd, that he had been seen in Whiteham Wood at night, checking moth traps with a lantern which he swung to and fro while declaiming, "I am the light of the world," suggests the opposite, if indeed he really thought he was unobserved. Ford's Ecological Genetics, a beautifully written, if rather egocentric, treatise, leaves the reader in no doubt of the demonstrated power of natural selection. I imbibed the same spirit as an undergraduate through teachers such as Ford's junior colleague Robert Creed, John Curry, Nico Tinbergen, who, though not a geneticist, did field experiments on the survival value of animal behaviour, which were staunchly adaptationist in style, and above all, Arthur Kane, the most philosophically and historically sophisticated of the Oxford school. Arthur's adaptationism was more than staunch. If not quite over the top, it was close to the summit. It was also well thought out. Maynard Smith invited him to introduce the closing discussion of the 1979 Royal Society Conference, and his animus towards Gould and Lewontin was palpable. He and I were sitting together in the front row before Gould began his talk, and Arthur was muttering to himself in a frenzy. He was especially incensed by an earlier published jibe by Lewontin against the Ford School as a British upper-middle-class activity, presumably an oblique reference to the genteel hobby of butterfly collecting. And he was rehearsing under his breath the reply that eventually appeared in his formal remarks. Presumably, when prejudice is strong, facts can be dispensed with as well. My own background and upbringing could only be distinguished by the extreme purist from working class. As we waited for Gould to begin, Arthur was bouncing up and down with nervous energy, and he quoted to me Stanley Holloway's "Let battle commence" from the "Sam, pick up thy musket" monologue. In 1964, Arthur had written a paper called The Perfection of Animals, which included a trenchant attack on the idea of trivial, non-functional characteristics of animals. I drew upon it in introducing my Constraints on Perfection chapter. Kane makes a similar point about so-called trivial characters, criticising Darwin for being too ready, under the at first sight surprising influence of Richard Owen, to concede functionlessness. No one will suppose that the stripes on the whelp of a lion or the spots on the young blackbird are of any use to these animals. Darwin's remark must sound foolhardy today even to the most extreme critic of adaptationism. Indeed, history seems to be on the side of the adaptationists, in the sense that in particular instances they have confounded the scoffers again and again. Kane's own celebrated work with Shepherd and their school on the selection pressures maintaining the banding polymorphism in the snail Cypion amaryllis may have been partly provoked by the fact that it had been confidently asserted that it could not matter to a snail whether it had one band on its shell or two. But perhaps the most remarkable functional interpretation of a trivial character is given by Manton's work on the diplopod Polyxenus, in which she has shown that a character formerly described as an ornament, and what could sound more useless, is almost literally the pivot of the animal's life. Astonishingly, however, the most extreme adaptationist quotation I could find was not from Kane, but from, of all people, Lewontin himself, writing in 1967, before his contrarian conversion set in. That is the one point which I think all evolutionists are agreed upon, that it is virtually impossible to do a better job than an organism is doing in its own environment. Starting with my Oxford bias towards adaptationism, my chapter went some way in what might seem to be the other direction, as I pinpointed some major constraints on perfection. Kane himself recognised that the animal we are looking at might be simply out of date, and he gave a working estimate of 2 million years as the upper bound for this. A more permanent constraint on perfection was suggested to me when I was an undergraduate by one of my tutors, John Curry, who also did research with Kane on snail population genetics. A branch of one of the cranial nerves, the recurrent laryngeal, runs from the brain to the larynx. It doesn't go straight there, however. Instead, it dives down into the chest, loops around one of the main arteries leaving the heart, and proceeds back up the neck to the larynx. In a giraffe, the detour is significant, British understatement, and it is presumably costly. The explanation lies in history, in the nerve's emergence in our fish ancestors before a discernible neck evolved. In those remote days, the most direct route of that nerve, its fishy equivalent, to what was then its target, did indeed lie posterior to what was then the equivalent artery, supplying one of the gills. As I put it in the extended phenotype, a major mutation might have rerouted the nerve completely, but only at a cost of great upheaval in early embryonic processes. Perhaps a prophetic, godlike designer back in the Devonian could have foreseen the giraffe and designed the original embryonic routing of the nerve differently, but natural selection has no foresight. Years later, in a 2010 Channel 4 television documentary called Inside Nature's Giants, I assisted in a revealing dissection of the recurrent laryngeal nerve of a giraffe which had died in a zoo. The scene had a dreamlike quality, which made it impossible to forget. The operating theatre was literally a theatre, the stage separated from the seated audience of veterinary students by a great wall of glass. The audience was in semi-darkness, and the fierce lights glaring down on the stage picked out the resemblance between the colour of the giraffe's patches and the orange overalls of the dissecting team with their uniform white Wellington boots. The giraffe had one hind leg hoisted aloft by a derrick, which added to the surreal quality of the scene. From time to time, I was invited by the television producer to advance to the glass wall and address the students with a microphone, explaining the evolutionary significance of the laryngeal nerve and its yards and yards of pointless diversion. Selection may be powerful, but it is impotent without genetic variation to select from. Pigs might fly if only the necessary mutations to sprout wings and change lots of other aerodynamically important things were forthcoming. It's controversial how great a constraint this is, and it really belongs in the field of embryology. I returned to the subject in what I hope was a constructive manner in Climbing Mount Improbable. Another apparent constraint is imposed by costs of materials. In The Extended Phenotype, I quoted from the Concord paper I had written with Jane Brockman in 1980. An engineer, given carte blanche on his drawing board, could design an ideal wing for a bird, but he would demand to know the constraints under which he must work. Is he constrained to use feathers and bones, or may he design the skeleton in titanium alloy? How much is he allowed to spend on the wings, and how much of the available economic investment must be diverted into, say, egg production? It was an economic constraint of this kind that Jane and I invoked to explain the apparent Concordian behaviour of her digger wasps. The Darwinian engineer in the classroom. I have explained how my tutorials as an undergraduate at Oxford predisposed me towards the adaptationism which later came in for criticism, and how I, together with other Oxford colleagues, later became involved in a defence of a more cautious, more thoughtful adaptationism. When I became a tutor myself, I found that my adaptationist bias had pedagogical advantages. It furnishes a narrative flow to help in remembering factual details of biology. As a lecturer and tutor, I continually sympathised with students facing the task of remembering huge numbers of facts, and I thought about how to make it easier. Medical students suffer the worst, and unfortunately, my favourite teaching trick, which I'm calling here the Darwinian engineer, probably would make little dent on the formidable array of sheer unyielding facts that human anatomy presents. This makes me even more proud of my daughter, Dr. Juliet Dawkins's first-class degree, especially given that St. Andrews is one of the few remaining medical schools that still teaches anatomy by hands-on dissection. The problem with anatomy, at least at the level of detail the best medical students teach, is that so many of its facts are discrete snippets of information that resist being threaded together in a necklace of coherent narrative that might prompt memory. Certainly, the broad highways of human anatomy make functional sense and can be taught accordingly, but the minute details of exactly which nerve goes over or under which artery, of literally vital importance for a surgeon, just have to be learned. If they make functional sense, and I expect they do, it is deeply buried, probably in internal intricacies of embryology, and hard to discern. Zoology students have an easier life than medics, although it wasn't always so. Peter Medawar, in 1965, quoted one of eight examination questions set in 1860 for students of comparative anatomy at University College London. By what special structures are bats enabled to fly through the air, and how do the Galeopithecae, the Pteromys, the Petauris, and Petauristae support themselves in that light element? Compare the structure of the wings of the bat with that of the bird, and with that of the extinct pterodactyl, and explain the structures by which the cobra expands its neck, and the saurian dragon flies through the atmosphere. By what structures do serpents spring from the ground, and fishes and cephalopods leap on deck from the waters? And how do flying fishes support themselves in the air? Explain the origin, the nature, the mode of construction, and the uses of the fibrous parachutes of arachnidans and larvae, and the cocoons which envelop the young. And describe the skeletal elements which support, and the muscles which move the meoptera and the metaptera of insects. Describe the structure, the attachments, and the principal varieties of form of the legs of insects, and compare them with the hollow articulated limbs of Nereides and the tubular feet of Lumbricae. How are the muscles disposed which move the solid setae of Stylaria, the cutaneous investment of Ascaris, the tubular peduncle of Pentalasmus, the wheels of Rotifera, the feet of Asterias, the mantle of Medusae, and the tubular tentacles of Asinae? How do entozoa effect the migrations necessary to their development and metamorphoses? How do the fishes Polypifera and Porifera distribute their progeny over the ocean? And lastly, how do the microscopic indestructible protozoa spread from lake to lake over the globe? Medawar quoted this preposterous exam question in evidence against the widespread view that science, as it advances, becomes less and less easy to master because there is more and more to learn. His characteristically provocative reply was that we actually have to learn less than our Victorian predecessors because multitudinous raw facts have become subsumed under relatively few general principles, the greatest of which was bequeathed by Darwin. Medawar had a point, but not for the first time, this laughing cavalier of the mind was exaggerating. He would have to admit that most papers in the journals Nature and Science today can be read only by specialists in their respective fields. Nevertheless, weaving facts together into a functional story is a powerful aid to memory, and it's one that I started using early on in my lecturing career at Oxford and Berkeley, and especially as a tutor at Oxford. This is what I meant when I said that adaptationism can have pedagogical advantages. The particular way I use it as a teacher is to take a problem faced by an animal and pose it as an engineer might. Then I list various solutions that might occur to the engineer, naming the pros and cons of each. Finally, I come on to the solution actually adopted by natural selection. This provides a narrative flow which grips and becomes an effortless guide to memory. I put the technique through its paces in the second chapter of both The Blind Watchmaker, the example of bat sonar, and Climbing Mount Improbable, the example of spider webs, and I'll reprise the examples here to illustrate it. First, the bats. The problem facing a bat is how to find its way around at night. Given that birds have got daytime aerial hunting sewn up, bats were driven to hunt by night, and that posed a problem. It's dark. An engineer might think of various solutions, each with its own knock-on problems. Emit your own light, like some deep-sea fish. Feel your way with long antennae like whip scorpions. Perfect an extreme sense of hearing like owls, so that the tiniest rustle betrays prey. An extreme sense of smell like moles, or extreme sense of touch like star-nosed moles. Or, finally, sonar. Emit loud sounds and exploit the echoes. Of these engineering solutions, the one actually adopted by bats is sonar. In various ways, bats time the echoes of their own ultrasonic shrieks and calculate the position and rate of change of relative position of obstacles and prey. But this raises further problems. Precise timing of the interval between a sound and its echo is improved if the sound is short. But the shorter and more staccato the sound, the harder it is to make it really loud, and it needs to be very loud because echoes are so faint. Could an engineer find a way to get the best of both worlds? One way is to make the sound not staccato. Have a longer cry, but modulate its pitch, swoop down or up through an octave or so during the course of each shriek. Now the shriek is not short, and it can therefore be loud. What is short is the time it spends at each pitch. When the echo bounces back, the brain knows that high-pitched echoes are from early parts of the shriek, low-pitched echoes from late parts of the shriek. The warden of my Oxford College at the time I was writing The Blind Watchmaker, the physicist Arthur Cook, had worked on the top-secret British radar project, then called RDF, in the Second World War, and he told me one evening at dinner that the same technique was used by radar engineers under the name chirp radar. Another engineering solution is to exploit the Doppler shift, the reason the ambulance siren drops in pitch as it rushes past you. Some bats make good use of this when tracking a moving target, such as an insect prey. Move on to the next engineering problem. Echoes, to repeat the point, are necessarily much fainter than the originating sounds, in danger of being too faint to hear. Possible engineering solutions: make the cries exceedingly loud and/or make the ears exceedingly sensitive. But those two solutions tread on each other's toes. Extremely sensitive ears are in danger of being deafened by extremely loud cries. Early Second World War radar faced an analogous problem, and again, Arthur Cook told me at dinner that the engineers solved it by designing what they called send-receive radar. And would you believe, the exactly equivalent solution is adopted by some bats. Temporarily switch your ears off just before you shriek, by tugging with a special-purpose muscle on the bones that transmit sound from the eardrum. Relax the muscle immediately after shrieking so your ear is restored to peak sensitivity in time to hear the echo. This cycle, tug, shriek, relax muscle, listen for echoes, tug again, has to be repeated for every shriek, and amazingly, the repeat rate can climb as high as 50 per second, faster than a machine gun, as the bat comes in for the kill, the final approach to an insect prey. The pedagogic advantage of the Darwinian engineer approach is that the facts become strung together in a memorable narrative, rather than having to be learned piecemeal. Indeed, there's a good chance that students will anticipate facts even before they are told them, which is good training for how to dream up fruitful hypotheses that might be worth testing in research. For example, bats often fly about in the company of hundreds of other bats. How might they solve the problem of their echoes being inadvertently jammed by all the other bat cries and echoes? Here's an idea that might occur to a student thinking like a Darwinian engineer. Imagine taking a movie film, cutting it up into its separate frames, shuffling the separate frames in a hat, and splicing them together again at random. Now the story would no longer make sense. Indeed, there would be no story, no consecutive narrative. In the same way, to an individual bat, all the other bats' echoes would sound like the equivalent of my movie film made of random frames, easily ignored because of their random unpredictability in relation to any story so far. Only the individual bat's own echoes would form a coherent narrative, making sense when spliced to their predecessors in the sequence of echoes. Experimental psychologists use the same kind of argument to solve the cocktail party problem. How do we manage to understand one conversation at a cocktail party when our ears are assailed by dozens of other conversations all around us? I use the same Darwinian engineer technique in Chapter 2 of Climbing Mount Improbable, but this time using the example of spider webs instead of bat sonar. Once again, start with a problem. How might a spider extend the effective length of its prey-catching limbs? Again, offer up various hypothetical solutions, culminating in the elegantly economical solution natural selection actually adopted, the silken web. And repeat the process for sub-problems and sub-sub-problems that subsequently open up. In a later chapter of the same book, called The Fortyfold Path to Enlightenment, I followed the same formula when talking about the design of eyes. Here, I carried the design-engineer approach to what some might consider an absurd extreme, but I hope an instructive one. A lens is a simple device, but the computational problem it solves is actually surprisingly sophisticated. I chose to dramatize this by imagining a computer picking up rays of light and bending them through a precisely calculated angle in order to focus an image on a screen. That would be ridiculously complicated, yet the task is easily solved by a lens, a device so simple that, as I demonstrated in my Royal Institution Christmas lectures, it can be approximated by a sagging, transparent plastic bag full of water, whose poorly focused image can be improved step by step up a smooth gradient on Mount Improbable. It's a metaphor for how easy it can be in practice to evolve something apparently complicated in theory. Long touted since Darwin's own time as his nemesis, the eye is easily evolved, and indeed has evolved several dozen times independently, all around the byways of the animal kingdom. The value of the Darwinian engineer approach for explaining things hit me much earlier when I was inspired separately by two Cambridge eye physiologists, W.A.H. Rushton and H.B. Barlow. I had met Rushton when I was still a schoolboy, for he had two sons at Arundel, one of whom was my exact contemporary. We played the clarinet together in the school orchestra, and Google tells me, no surprise, that he later made his career as an academic musicologist. Presumably because the eminent Professor Rushton had two sons at the school, he agreed to give a talk to the sixth form biology group. Rushton made an interesting distinction between analogue and digital signalling systems. In an analogue telephone, the continuously varying pressure wave of the spoken sound is transduced into a parallel voltage wave in a wire, which is transduced back again into sound in the earpiece at the other end. The problem is that if the wire is long, the electrical signal attenuates and has to be boosted by an amplifier. Boosting inevitably introduces random noise. That doesn't matter if there are only a few boosting stations along the line. But given a sufficiently large number of boosting stations, the accumulated noise overwhelms the signal, and the conversation becomes an unintelligible hiss. This is why nerves, at least long ones, cannot work like analog telephone wires. Nerves aren't wires carrying electric currents. They're even less hi-fi, more like fizzing trails of gunpowder acting as a fuse, with the added complication of the nodes of Ranvier, which can be seen as discrete boosting stations. The upshot is that a nerve has the noisy equivalent of hundreds of boosting stations strung out along its length. How might an engineer solve the noise problem? By abandoning all hope of conveying information via the height, voltage, of the wave. Instead, turn the wave into a spike whose height is fixed, or anyway irrelevant. Convey information not by the height of the spike, but by the chattering patterns of a sequence of variable spikes. For example, signal a loud sound with a rapid burst of spikes in quick succession, a quiet sound by few spikes, well separated in time. So that's an interesting biological solution to an engineering problem. But, as with the bats and spiders, one solution leads on to the next problem, which needs another engineering solution. And this brings me to the second of my Cambridge influences, Horace Barlow. My first wife, Marion, and I met Horace, named after his grandfather, Sir Horace Darwin, Charles's son, when we were at Berkeley, California, and attended his lectures as a visiting professor on sensory physiology. These lectures were notable for the fact that Horace usually turned up at least half an hour late. It was worth the wait. An immensely clever man, he was also a fount of idiosyncratic amusement. You could tell when a joke was on its way, some seconds before it arrived, just by watching his face. The Barlow paper that inspired us dated from about 10 years before we heard his lectures. It was the reason we went out of our way to attend them. And it completely changed my approach to teaching about sensory systems. Indeed, we both became obsessed with the Barlow paper, and for a period it dominated many of our science conversations with each other. The very name, Horace Barlow, became a kind of shorthand between us to refer to a whole thread of thought that we were sharing at the time. My lectures on behavioural physiology to Berkeley students at the time became dominated by the Darwinian engineer approach. You remember I said just now that nerves signal loud sounds not by the height of the spike, but by the frequency or timing of the spikes, and the same goes for high temperature, bright light, etc. That's true, but it raises a further engineering problem. If the frequency of nerve spikes is simply proportional to the intensity of the signal, the necessary information is indeed conveyed, but the process is wasteful, and wasteful in a profoundly interesting way. The wastage is remediable by removing redundancy. What is redundancy? The state of the world at any one moment is pretty much the same as it was in the previous moment. The world doesn't change at random, capriciously. Like journalists reporting news, nerves reporting on the state of the world need to send a signal only when there is a change. Don't say, "It's loud, it's loud, it's loud, it's loud, it's loud." Instead say, "A loud sound has started." Assume no change until further notice. This is where redundancy comes in as a technical term in information theory. Once you know the current state of the world, further reports of the same state are redundant. Redundancy is the inverse of information. Information is a mathematically precise measure of surprise. In the time domain, information means changes in the state of the world from one moment to the next, because only changes have surprise value. Redundancy in this context means sameness. The receiver of multiple messages doesn't have to monitor all channels all the time, only those that signal a change. This could only fail to be helpful if the world changed randomly and capriciously all the time, which fortunately, well, obviously, it doesn't. Redundancy filtering was Barlow's engineering solution to the problem of economical signalling in the time domain, and sure enough, it is implemented by nervous systems in the form of sensory adaptation. Most sensory systems send a rapid burst of spikes every time they detect a change, after which the spike rate settles down to a low or even zero rate until there is another change. There's an analogous engineering problem in the spatial domain. If you think of an eye or a digital camera looking at a scene, most cells in the retina, or pixels in the camera, will be seeing the same thing as their neighbours in the retina or camera. This is because the world scenes are not capriciously random, pepper and salt, but are typically made up of large patches of uniform colour, like the sky or a whitewashed wall. Away from an edge, Every pixel sees the same as its neighbours, and to report it is a waste of pixels. The economical way to convey the information is for the sender to report on edges, and for the receiver, the brain in this case, to fill in the swathes of uniform colour between the edges. Barlow pointed out that this engineering problem too has its neat redundancy-reducing solution in biology. It's called lateral inhibition. Lateral inhibition is the equivalent of sensory adaptation, but in the spatial, not the temporal, domain. Each cell in the array of pixels, in addition to sending nerve spikes to the brain, inhibits its immediate neighbours. Cells that are sitting in the middle of a patch of uniform colour are inhibited from all sides and therefore send only few, if any, spikes to the brain. Cells that are sitting on the edge of a patch of colour receive inhibition from their neighbours on only one side. So the brain gets the majority of its spikes from edges. The redundancy problem is solved, or at least mitigated. Barlow introduced his article, and it was this that especially grabbed Marion's and my imagination, with a mind-stretching thought experiment. Imagine that for every pattern the brain might ever want to recognise, every tree, every predator, every prey, every face, every letter of the alphabet, of the Greek alphabet, there was one nerve cell hooked up to the retina in such a way that it fired when its own shape fell on the retina. Each of these brain cells is wired up to a keyhole combination of pixels so that it fires only when the correct keyhole shape is seen. It also has to be wired up negatively to the anti-keyhole, all the pixels other than the keyhole, otherwise it would fire when it saw a blank field of light covering the whole keyhole. That sounds fine, but on second thoughts it can't be true. Remember that all the shapes needing to be recognised by these overlapping keyholes may be presented in thousands of different orientations and from any distance. The number of overlapping keyholes, with the rest of the retina in each case being an anti-keyhole, would be so prodigiously large that their corresponding brain cells would have to be more numerous than all the atoms in the world. Fred Atneeve, an American psychologist who independently thought up the same idea as Barlow, estimated that the volume of the brain would have to be measured in cubic light years. The solution, redundancy reduction, extends beyond sensory adaptation and lateral inhibition to a fascinating list of feature detector neurons in the brain, such as horizontal line detectors, vertical line detectors, bug detectors, and others, all of which can be represented as redundancy reducing in the Barlow-Atneeve sense. For example, a straight line can be represented as just its two ends, leaving the brain to fill in the redundant intermediate points. As with the bats and the spiderwebs, the whole Barlow story can be told as an elegant and easily memorized sequence of problems with engineering solutions, giving rise to new problems, suggesting new engineering solutions, and so on. We should also expect that the detector cells that evolve in the brain of an animal of a particular species will be tuned to detect not only features that are redundant in the sensory stream, but features that are functionally important for animals of that species, for example, the colour and shape of a sexual partner. These two combined would mean that a comprehensive list of the detector cells in an animal's brain should amount to a kind of indirect description of the important properties of the world in which the species lives. And this idea, in turn, is related to another one, this time my own, the genetic book of the dead. The idea here is that the genes of an animal could in theory be read as a digital description of the environments in which its ancestors have survived. The genetic book of the dead and the species as averaging computer. River Out of Eden begins by looking back at the reader's ancestors and reflecting, trivially when you think about it, but still significantly, that not a single one of your ancestors died young or failed to achieve at least one heterosexual copulation. Every individual born inherits the genes of a literally unbroken line of successful ancestors. We inherit the genes that equipped this progenitorial elite, as I call them, to be an elite. The exact means by which an individual becomes a successful ancestor varies from species to species, but however they do it, we are all descended from individuals who were good at it. Good at it means good at flying in the case of birds, bats and pterosaurs, good at digging in the case of moles, aardvarks and wombats, good at hunting in the case of lions, hawks and pike, good at fighting in the case of male deer, elephant seals and parasitic fig wasps. There is a sense, therefore, in which the DNA of a species could in principle be read out as a kind of description of the way of life at which that species excels. I have mentioned this idea of the genetic book of the dead in several of my books, but I argued it most fully in the chapter of that name in Unweaving the Rainbow. Here's one of the ways I introduced it. A species is an averaging computer. It builds up, over the generations, a statistical description of the worlds in which the ancestors of today's species members lived and reproduced. That description is written in the language of DNA. It lies not in the DNA of any one individual, but collectively in the DNA, the selfish cooperators, of the whole breeding population. Perhaps readout captures it better than description. If you find an animal's body, a new species previously unknown to science, a knowledgeable zoologist allowed to examine and dissect its every detail should be able to read its body and tell you what kind of environment its ancestors inhabited – desert, rainforest, arctic tundra, temperate woodland or coral reef. The zoologist should be able to tell you, by reading its teeth and its guts, what it fed on. Flat millstone teeth and long intestines with complicated blind alleys indicate that it was a herbivore. Sharp, shearing teeth and short, uncomplicated guts indicate a carnivore. The animal's feet and its eyes and other sense organs spell out the way it moved and how it found its food. Its stripes or flashes, its horns, antlers or crests provide a readout for the knowledgeable of its social and sex life. I call the species an averaging computer, but why is it the species that's the averaging computer, not the individual organism? Because, at least in sexually reproducing animals, any one individual genome is but an ephemeral sample of the gene pool that has been sieved and winnowed down the generations, averaging the conditions and adversities which individuals of ancestral generations braved and survived. The species gene pool is a kind of negative image of the average environment of individuals of the species. If we think of natural selection as a sculptor chiseling rough raw materials towards ever-increasing perfection, the entity that is chiseled is the species gene pool. Each individual's genome is a sample of that gene pool, and the survival or failure of the individual depends, among other things, upon the set of genes that it was lucky enough or unlucky enough to draw from the pool. I first tried to convey the idea of gene success being dependent on their genetic companions in The Selfish Gene in 1976 with my metaphor of reshuffled rowing crews, where the oarsmen stand for genes and the successively re-crewed boats stand for organisms. Like many metaphors, this one should not be pushed too far, but it does convey the idea that the best genes, in the long run, will tend to survive in the gene pool, even though many copies of them perish because they are dragged down by inferior fellow crew members in particular bodies. It is the gene pool that improves in the long run as natural selection chips its way down the generations. It is but a short step from here to the image of the genetic book of the dead. It's important to understand that the environment is not directly imprinted on the genes. That would be Lamarckism. Rather, the genes vary at random, and the ones that fit the environment survive to populate the gene pool of the future. I think it was while giving tutorials that it first occurred to me that a sufficiently knowledgeable zoologist should in principle be able to read out from the anatomy, physiology and DNA of a species how and where it lived, who its enemies were, the weather it had to contend with and so on. I was teaching the principles of taxonomy, the science of animal classification. Animals that are unrelated but have similar ways of life tend to resemble each other in superficial features, which are in danger of distracting us from the features they share with their true taxonomic relatives. Dolphins superficially resemble marlins because both swim fast near the surface of the sea, but these superficial resemblances are outnumbered by the features by which dolphins resemble land mammals and those by which marlins resemble other fish. Numerical methods exist for estimating these competing resemblances independently of whether they are ancestral or recent. Such numerical taxonomy methods are less fashionable nowadays than they were when I learned them as an undergraduate from Arthur Kane, but they are good for illustrating the point. you measure everything you can find about a whole lot of species, feed all the measurements into a computer, and ask the computer to come up with a figure for the distance between each species and each other species. Distance here doesn't, of course, mean spatial distance. It means how much they resemble each other, their distance from each other in a multidimensional mathematical resemblance space. What you hope to find is that although dolphins and marlins are pulled a little bit closer to each other than they should be because of their similar ways of life, these similarities, streamlining and so on, are swamped by the much more numerous differences stemming from the fact that one is a mammal and the other is a fish. They've had a very long time to diverge from each other since the Devonian period. The numerical calculations filter off the superficial minority resemblances by swamping them, leaving us with the fundamental majority resemblances that indicate pedigree relationships. It occurred to me, while thinking aloud together with pupils in tutorials, that those numerical methods might in principle be stood on their head. Instead of filtering off the superficial functional characteristics, like the streamlined shape of dolphins and marlins, leaving the true taxonomic characters, we could do the opposite. Go out of our way to filter off the taxonomic characters that stem from relatedness and concentrate on the minority of functional resemblances. How might this be done? Imagine that we construct a set of pairs of animals. The first of each pair thrives in water, the second on dry land. Yet, taxonomically speaking, each animal is more closely related to its pair than to any of the others on its side of the pairings. Otter, badger, beaver, gopher, yapok, opossum, water shrew, land shrew, water vole, vole, pond snail, land spider, marine iguana, land iguana. Suppose we make hundreds of measurements on all these animals and lots more similar pairs, anatomical measurements, physiological measurements, biochemical measurements, genetic sequences, and then take them all and throw them into a computer, telling the computer which member of each pair is aquatic, which terrestrial. Now ask the computer, this is not as easy as it sounds, but methods exist for doing it, questions like this: what do the aquatic animals in each case have in common, as opposed to their terrestrial counterparts? We might get a bit subtler than this. Instead of asking our animals to tick a box, either aquatic or terrestrial, we might place them along a gradient of aquatic ness and look for quantitative correlations along the gradient. We might even make so bold as to ask, what measurements of an animal would I have to multiply by what factor in order to morph it from terrestrial to aquatic? We could then do the same thing for pairs of arboreal versus ground-dwelling species, squirrel, rat, tree frog, tree kangaroo, wallaby. Then the same for pairs of underground versus above-ground species, mole, shrew, mole cricket, mole rat, and so on. In the case of aquatic versus terrestrial, we might expect webbed feet to pop up as one answer, and that's pretty obvious. But I would hope the computer would find less obvious answers buried deep inside the animals. Something about blood chemistry, for example. And to bring us back to the genetic book of the dead, we could do the same exercise with genes. Are there genes that tie aquatic animals to other aquatic animals, in spite of their not being particularly closely related? We normally expect genetic comparisons to tell us which animals are closely related. With respect to most of their genes, marine and land iguanas, being close cousins, will certainly come out closely resembling each other. But I would also hope to do the opposite, find a few genes that marine iguanas have in common with other marine creatures and don't share with land iguanas or other dry land animals, perhaps a gene concerned with excretion of salt. It was considerations such as this, talked through and argued about with pupil after pupil in tutorials down the years, that led me to coin phrases like genetic book of the dead and to suggest that a sufficiently knowledgeable zoologist, when presented with an unknown animal, should eventually, with the help of a computer, be able to reconstruct the way of life of that animal, more strictly of its ancestors. In particular, the genes that helped the animal's ancestors to survive are in principle decipherable as a coded description of its ancestral world, ancestral predators, ancestral climate, ancestral parasites, ancestral social system. And in those tutorials, where my pupils and I threw these ideas around, I was mindful of my own tutor, Arthur Kane, and his dictum that the animal is what it is because it needs to be. On one occasion, as a graduate student, I found myself in the Royal Oak pub in Oxford, known as the Doctor's Pub because the old Radcliffe Infirmary was opposite, having a solitary supper of, I'm chagrined to say, bacon and eggs. Arthur, coincidentally, happened to be doing the same thing, in the same pub, so we joined each other, like, I'm also chagrined to recall, the two travelling men who founded the Gideons. We talked about taxonomy and adaptation, and Arthur at one point illustrated his theme by suggesting that a squirrel might be described as a rat which had moved a certain distance away from a rat-like ancestor along the arboreality dimension. That image stayed with me and informed the chapter of Unweaving the Rainbow called The Genetic Book of the Dead, and also the idea of the Museum of All Possible Animals, which dominated two chapters of Climbing Mount Improbable, and I'll come on to it soon. But the museum was more directly inspired by my attempts at computer modelling, which began while I was writing The Blind Watchmaker. Evolution in Pixels. Chapter 3 of The Blind Watchmaker, Accumulating Small Change, occupied as much time and effort as the other 10 chapters put together. This was because of the weeks and months I spent writing the suite of computer programs called Blind Watchmaker, designed to breed computer biomorphs on the screen by artificial selection. The word biomorph was borrowed from my friend Desmond Morris, whose surrealist paintings depict quasi-biological forms which, by his own entirely believable account, evolve from canvas to canvas. Desmond's painting, The Expectant Valley, had been used for the cover of The Selfish Gene. I bought the original at one of Desmond's exhibitions because the price, £750, was exactly equal to the advance given me by Oxford University Press, and the omen pricked my fancy. When, a decade later, I spoke to Desmond about The Blind Watchmaker, he was so taken with the title that he set to work there and then on a painting with the same title. And this new painting, though it had more to do with the title than the contents of the book, later graced the covers of both the Longman and the Penguin editions of The Blind Watchmaker. I wrote my computer biomorph program in Pascal, a now largely superseded language, which itself was a direct descendant of the even more thoroughly superseded Algol 60 language that I had learned as a graduate student. I had continual recourse to the Apple Macintosh toolbox, the repertoire of hardwired machine code programs that gives the Mac its characteristic and notoriously imitated look and feel, and the half-dozen technical manuals of the Mac toolbox became my much-thumbed, increasingly grubby and messily annotated Bible. I was also continually running to the ever-patient Alan Graffen for help and advice. Not that he was a more experienced Mac programmer than I was, rather the reverse, but he has undenied advantages in the IQ department. As P.G. Woodhouse might have put it, north of the collar stud, Alan stands alone. Or, as Marion said of him, he has the most annoying habit of being right. During the course of my programming marathon, Alan once rather endearingly said he felt sorry for me because I was mired in a peculiarly difficult piece of coding, but I'd got into it too deep to back out. That sounds Concordian, and to an extent it was. Backing out would have meant throwing away all the work I'd put in so far. But there was more to it than that. I was driven to persist, and for this I dare to take credit, even to feel a little proud, by a biological intuition, almost like an instinctive nose for what I, as a biologist, could scent must work. I was propelled forwards by a conviction that something truly exciting must eventually emerge from my biomorph-generating algorithm, if only I persisted and got myself out of the mire of complexity. The key to it was the fractal nature of the embedded embryology of my biomorphs, the recursive tree-growing procedure whose quantitative details were controlled by a set of 9, more in later versions of the program, numbers, which I called genes. Obviously, if you change the numerical values of the genes, you'll change the morphology of the biomorph. Less obviously, the change is often in a biologically interesting direction. I imported Darwinism, though not sex, by asexually breeding daughter biomorphs from parent biomorphs using artificial selection. The computer offered up a choice of daughter biomorphs with slightly mutated genes, and the human chooser picked the one that was to give birth to the next generation, and so forth for an indefinite number of generations. The numerical values of the genes were concealed, Just like a breeder of cattle or roses, the biomorph breeder saw only the consequences of genetic change, the morphology on the computer screen. In my dreams, then, I foresaw that something interesting and unexpected would emerge. But I never dared hope that my biomorphs would evolve their way from botany to entomology. When I wrote the program, I never thought that it would evolve anything more than a variety of tree-like shapes. I had hoped for weeping willows, cedars of Lebanon, Lombardy poplars, seaweeds, perhaps deer antlers. Nothing in my biologist's intuition, nothing in my 20 years' experience of programming computers, and nothing in my wildest dreams prepared me for what actually emerged on the screen. I can't remember exactly when in the sequence it first began to dawn on me that an evolved resemblance to something like an insect was possible. With a wild surmise, I began to breed generation after generation from whichever child looked most like an insect. My incredulity grew in parallel with the evolving resemblance. I still cannot conceal from you my feeling of exultation as I first watched these creatures emerging before my eyes. I distinctly heard the triumphal opening chords of Also sprach Zarathustra, the 2001 theme, in my mind. I couldn't eat, and that night my insects swarmed behind my eyelids as I tried to sleep. There are computer games on the market in which the player has the illusion that he is wandering about in an underground labyrinth which has a definite, if complex, geography, and in which he encounters dragons, minotaurs, or other mythic adversaries. In these games, the monsters are rather few in number. They're all designed by a human programmer, and so is the geography of the labyrinth. In the evolution game, whether the computer version or the real thing, the player, or observer, obtains the same feeling of wandering metaphorically through a labyrinth of branching passages, but the number of possible pathways is all but infinite, and the monsters that one encounters are undesigned and unpredictable. On my wanderings through the backwaters of Biomorph Land, I've encountered fairy shrimps, Aztec temples, Gothic church windows, Aboriginal drawings of kangaroos, and on one memorable but unrecapturable occasion, a passable caricature of the Wickham Professor of Logic. The latter paragraph touches on one of the main biological lessons that I took away with me from this programming exercise. The inner eye of my imagination saw Biomorph Land, a multidimensional landscape of morphology, a nine-dimensional hypercube in which all possible biomorphs lurked, every one connected to every other one by a navigable trajectory of step-by-step, gradual evolution. In theory, though less tidily because the number of genes is not fixed, we can imagine all possible real animals as sitting in an n-dimensional hypercube, and I call this genetic space in Chapter 3 of The Blind Watchmaker. Most of the inhabitants of this monstrous, I use the word advisedly, hypercube, not only have never existed, but never could have survived if they had done. However many ways there may be of being alive, it is certain that there are vastly more ways of being dead. A sentence that, I am pleased to see, has made it into the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. Actual animals are islands in this hyperspace, vastly spaced out from one another, as if in some hyper-Polynesia, surrounded by a fringing reef of closely related animals and separated from other islands by largely impassable wastes of impossible animals. Actual evolution is represented by timelines, trajectories through the hypercube. You see, although I'm no good at writing equations or getting my sums right, I do perhaps have the rudiments of the soul of a mathematician, or so I would aspire. Dan Dennett later fruitfully elaborated the idea under the name Library of Mendel, and I too carried it further in Climbing Mount Improbable in my fanciful Museum of All Possible Animals. Imagine a museum with galleries stretching towards the horizon in every direction. Preserved in the museum is every kind of animal form that has ever existed and every kind that could be imagined. Each animal is housed next door to those that it most resembles. Each dimension in the museum, that is, each direction along which a gallery extends, corresponds to one dimension in which the animals vary. The galleries crisscross one another in multidimensional space, not just the ordinary three-dimensional space that we, with our limited minds, are capable of visualizing. In Climbing Mount Improbable, I introduced this museum using the rather special example of mollusk shells. it had been understood for a while that a shell is a logarithmically expanding tube growing at the margin. If we ignore the cross-sectional shape of the tube, for example by assuming it's a circle, the form of every shell is determined by only three numbers, which, in Climbing Mount Improbable, I dubbed flare, verm and spire. Flare determines the rate of expansion of the tube as it grows. Spire determines the departure from the plane. Spire is zero in a typical ammonite, all in one plane, but has a high value in, say, turritella. Flare is high in a cockle. Indeed, the tube expands so rapidly it runs out before it reaches the point of looking like a tube at all. Low in turritella. Verm takes longer to explain in words, but high verm is epitomised by spirula in the picture in the E appendix. As the American paleontologist David Raup realised, if there are only three numbers governing variation in shape of a set of animals, all those animals can be accommodated in a simple mathematical space, a three-dimensional cube. We don't need a hypercube, an actual cube will do. And by the same token, I realised that I could write a snail version of my biomorph programme with only three genes instead of nine. Instead of choosing which of a set of tree-like biomorphs to breed from, I could present snailomorphs, or, let's not mix our languages, conchomorphs. By choosing the favoured breeder generation after generation, it should be possible to evolve from any shell to any other. Evolution would be a step-by-step trajectory through the cube of all possible shells. To write the programme, I had only to substitute a new three-gene snail embryology module in place of the original nine-gene biomorphs embryology. All the rest was the same. And it did indeed prove very easy to breed any shell starting from any other shell, simply by choosing in every generation the shell that most resembled the target. 3D printers hadn't been invented in those days. If I'd had one, I would have printed the entire cube. As it was, I had to be content with printing the six edges of the cube on flat squares of paper, which I glued to the outside of a cardboard box. There's a photo in the E appendix of Lala holding the snail box. Presumably, real-life evolution is free to wander anywhere in the cube, the virtual museum of all possible shells. However, as Raup had earlier noted, there are some sizable no-go areas, volumes rather, in which, although the mathematics would permit it, no shells have ever actually survived. This is because these forms would be functionally inviable. Mutants that strayed into these here-be-dragon zones simply died. In the E appendix are four mathematically possible denizens of an untenanted region of the cube. They don't exist as shells, although, interestingly, they do exist as horns of antelopes and other bovids. But it isn't strictly true that the museum of all possible shells is a three-dimensional cube. It's this only if we ignore the cross-sectional shape of the growing tube and assume that it is, for example, a perfect circle. I tried making it a variable ellipse instead of a circle by adding a fourth gene to the original three. But real life isn't as geometrically perfect as that. For many shells, the cross-sectional shape is not easy to specify mathematically, though it is, of course, in principle possible. So I resorted to entering it into the programme freehand. Apart from this modification to the embryology module, the programme remained the same with only three genes, and I was able to breed an encouragingly realistic menagerie of shells on my computer screen. See the E appendix. In addition to the original tree embryology and the snail embryology, were there yet more embryology modules that could be imported into my evolution programme? I had long been fascinated by D'Arcy Thompson's transformations. That great Scottish zoologist had been one of those who inspired Raup and later me in our shell work. But he was best known for his demonstration that a biological form could be transformed into a related form by a mathematical transformation. You can visualise it by drawing an animal form, say the crab Geryon, on a sheet of stretched rubber. Then you find that you can transform the shape into a variety of related crabs by stretching the rubber in mathematically specified ways. The E appendix shows D'Arcy Thompson's representation of this process. Geryon is drawn on squared graph paper, rubber, at top left. The, alas only approximate, forms of five other crabs is obtained by distorting the graph coordinates, stretching the rubber, in five different mathematically elegant ways. I had long been fascinated to dream of what might Darcy Thompson have done with a computer. Indeed, I once set it as an exam question in the final Honour School of Zoology at Oxford. I don't think anybody answered it, perhaps sadly because none of their lectures had equipped them to do so. And, I suppose it's understandable, nervous exam candidates like to play it safe. Now I wanted to try to answer my own question by modifying my biomorph program. The genes, instead of controlling the development of a tree, would mathematically control the stretching of virtual rubber in the computer. As with the conchomorphs, it would be necessary to rewrite only the kernel embryology routine of the original biomorphs program. All the rest could remain the same. It should be possible to evolve from Geryon to, say, Corystes, through step-by-step selection. Following Darcy Thompson himself, I was prepared to overlook the fact that these crabs are all modern species, none descended from any other. I was captivated by the idea that related animals can be seen as stretched, twisted, distorted versions of each other, distorted versions of their neighbours in the great mathematical museum of all animals. The mathematical and computer skills required were beyond me, even if I'd had the time to exercise them, so I joined a consortium at Oxford to bid for a grant to hire two programmers. One was to work on my Darcy Thompson project, and the other on an unconnected project concerned with agriculture. The programmer who came to work on my project was Will Atkinson, and he proved to be everything I could have wished for. The genes in Will's Darcy program did a variety of things. Some changed the stretched rubber from rectangle to trapezium, the magnitude of the distortion determined by the numerical value of the gene. Some changed one or both axes to logarithmic, or did various other mathematical transformations. The biological shape drawn on the rubber changed progressively as the observer chose favoured progeny for breeding, just as in my original biomorphs program. Elegantly written as Will's program was, the forms that it evolved seemed to get less and less biological as the generations went by. The evolving animals increasingly looked like degenerate versions of their ancestors, rather than newly viable transformations, not like real evolutionary descendants, as my original evolving biomorphs did. Will and I worked out the reason for this, and it is an informative one. The Darcy morphs don't have an embryology. What evolves from one generation to the next is not the animal forms themselves, but the rubber on which they are drawn. And Darcy Thompson's original transformations, after all, were never really evolutionary, since the animals he drew were both adult and modern. Adult animals don't change into other adult animals. Embryonic processes evolve from the embryonic processes of ancestors. Julian Huxley, my sometime predecessor as tutor in zoology at New College, modified Darcy Thompson's method to transform embryos into adults, and this, as Peter Medawar pointed out, is a more biologically realistic usage. The reason my original biomorphs were fertile, even creative, in generating biological form is that they had an embryology, a recursive branching tree, which had a kind of built-in propensity to keep evolving in freshly interesting directions. The conchomorphs, too, had their own, very different, but still biologically interesting embryology, capable of generating a rich variety of biologically realistic forms. Isn't real-life embryology creative like that? Do embryologies even evolve to become better at generating evolution? Could there be a kind of higher-level selection of embryologies, choosing those that are evolutionarily fecund? This was the germ of my idea of the evolution of evolvability, and I'll return to it in a moment. My original biomorphs in The Blind Watchmaker, with their 9 genes, meander their evolutionary way within the confines of a 9-dimensional hypercube. Evolutionary trends consisted of an inch-by-inch walk through this particular hypercube, this 9-dimensional museum of all biomorphs. I was interested in possible ways of escaping from the hypercube altogether, out into a larger hypercube. One way of doing this was by substituting a completely different embryology, for example, replacing tree embryology with snail embryology, and I pursued it. But before I did that, I was interested in exploring the consequences of increasing the number of genes affecting my existing embryology, the embryology of the original tree biomorphs. This would be equivalent to expanding to more than 9 the number of dimensions of mathematical space available for evolution, and I hoped it would give me insight into real biological evolution. I did it in two stages. The second stage introduced genes for colour and made its debut in Climbing Mount Improbable. The first stage, still monochrome, appeared in an appendix added to the 1991 reprint of The Blind Watchmaker. There, I upped the number of genes from 9 to 16. The branching tree embryology remained at the core, and the new genes, once again genes were just numbers, implemented various ways of drawing this basic biomorph. Segmentation genes drew a series of biomorphs in line astern, mimicking the segments of an earthworm or a centipede. One gene determined how many segments were drawn, another controlled the distance between segments, another implemented gradients of progressive change as you went from front to back. Segmented biomorphs, see the E appendix, resembled arthropods even more than my Zarathustra insects. They look biological, don't they, even if you can't pin them down to particular real-life species. Another suite of genes mirrored biomorphs in various planes of symmetry. The 16-dimensional hypercube, with its new symmetry genes and segmentation genes, permitted the evolution of a much wider repertoire of biomorphs than were permitted in the original 9-dimensional space. It was even possible to breed a rather imperfect alphabet with which I ineptly attempted to sign my name, CE appendix. It would have been completely impossible to breed an alphabet with the original 9 genes, and the imperfections of the letters discoverable in the 16-dimensional hypercube suggest that further genes would be needed to increase the flexibility of biomorph evolution. Such thoughts led me back to biology and to propose the idea of the evolution of evolvability.